Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Later on in the hour, we'll hear about the pros and cons of San Francisco's Prop D, a proposal to streamline the number of commissions. And we'll talk with local author Caroline Paul about her latest book, Tough Broad. But first, as everyone in California knows, it's fire season. As of today, 6,000 fires are burning in California and nearly 1 million acres have burned. What is the state doing to address wildfires and how can people protect their home and property from fire? Those are questions that our guest, Lisa Lean Maker, contends with every day. Maker is the California Deputy Secretary for Forest and Wildfire Resilience, and she joins us tonight. Welcome to State of the Bay, Lisa.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the opportunity.
Oh, well, it's great to have you. I mean, I wanted to start with what your job is exactly. I mean, it seems like a big one, Secretary for the Forest and Wildfire Resilience. What do you address day to day in your position?
Great question. So I'm one of several policy deputies here at the Natural Resources Agency, working for Natural Resources Secretary Wade Crowfoot. So we have, each of us, a various portfolio dealing with different aspects of our natural resources here. And, you know, we're really focused on the daily on driving forward on our policy initiatives and our, you know, kind of key priorities. So for me, what that means is I spend a lot of time thinking about how to leverage every tool and resource at our disposal to really move the needle on progress in our forest and wildfire resilient space. You know, it's challenging, as you said, it's a big job, but so much of it has to do with collaborating, coordinating within my agency, various departments that work on this issue, but also a lot of our external partners. And I would say that's been one of the most exciting, you know, developments and really game changers in the last few years has been the development of so many collaborative partnerships that are helping us get work done on the ground.
You know, wildfire has always been part of California because wildfire is a natural thing. But these catastrophic wildfires that we've seen, starting with the Tubbs Fire in 2017 and 2018, have kind of changed how Californians view fire and what, when we say fire season, you know, what that means for people. In the years that you've been in the job, how has the state's approach to wildfire changed?
Yeah, you're exactly right. There has been a major uptick in the risk of wildfire and the severity that we've been seeing. You know, don't need to remind your listeners of that. Certainly they can see it with their own eyes in the summertime when we've had these huge smoke events. And really what we're seeing is a combination of things where, you know, climate change and decades of fire suppression are kind of combining to drive a dramatic increase in the size and the intensity of these fires. You know, 2020 and 2021 just literally smashed the records in terms of most destructive fires. The first time we saw a fire go up the entire spine of the Sierra Nevada from one side, the crest from one side to the other, and it happened twice. So, you know, no question it's getting more severe due to those factors. So, you know, in response to that, though, this administration really, really leaned in on how to surge investments into a few different areas so that we could try to, you know, try to turn the tide a little bit. So, you know, we with the leadership of the legislature, obviously, and Governor Newsom, we were able to dedicate historic funding to let us do some of this upfront proactive action to really try to reduce wildfire risks, protect communities, and you know, essentially restore the health of our landscapes, which have gotten kind of out of balance. So these investments total something like $2.6 billion that go across 40 different programs. To date, I think the last stat I saw was this has resulted in over 1,900 fuel reduction projects, home hardening projects, and other kinds of resilience work that's happening up and down the state. In 2023 alone, the state invested nearly $500 million directly in communities for over 250 new wildfire and forest resilience grants. So, I mean, I just say this to say that we've responded with a huge historic investment of these resources, and we're starting to see that it's having an outcome. You know, some of these projects, as we're tracking them, we can see that they are they have already, in some cases, influenced wildfire behavior and helped to, you know, make a fire, you know, become less catastrophic, essentially. So, Another thing that's really worth noting is that all of these investments are helping us to implement what we call the California Wildfire and Forest Resilience Action Plan. This was a whole effort stood up around the same time when this blinking light on the dashboard was happening with how severe these fires were, right? So, you know, we have this action plan now that outlines, you know, tons of different priorities, and it really is serving as our roadmap with, you know, the California and federal partners and also our locals to, you know, really get in there and strategically think about how to increase the pace and scale of the work to match this challenge.
Well, you know, you talked about forest resilience, and I always think about that time that then President Donald Trump visited California and said to Gavin Newsom, yeah, you know, we should rake the forest floor to provide resilience. Tell me exactly what your organization or your department has done to make the forests more resilient against fire. I mean, you mentioned it, but what specifically is happening?
Yeah, so just a gamut of projects are being funded through grant programs that we have stood up here, and then that we're also then able to leverage resources coming from our federal partners. So when we talk about this kind of work, we're thinking about forest thinning, where we're literally going in and trying to, you know, make these stands of trees less dense. Oh, you know, over time, they've just become overstocked, which leaves them in an unhealthy state. So that's a big part of it, is going through and doing ecological thinning, forest thinning, to just really, you know, reduce that density. A lot of fuels treatment. In some areas that have previously burned, you have a ton of brush and other kinds of vegetation that spring up and are sitting there like fuel for the next time a fire comes through. So we're really working on that kind of fuels reduction. Another big aspect of this is constructing shaded fuel breaks in some of our forests and around communities. This allows, you know, a corridor or a space where CAL FIRE and other first responders can actually take a stand against a fire that's coming. So fuel breaks are important. We're seeing how they are helping, even with these fires this year that we've seen. They're not designed necessarily to stop a fire from moving, but they do serve to slow down the spread of that fire and create that space for firefighters to respond. And then another big thing to mention too is, of course, a lot of investments to help homeowners create defensible space around their homes, and as well as at the community level. So we're kind of pulling the lever on all of these things at the same time to try to turn the tide.
You know, a lot of people want to live in these wooey areas, which is, I believe, wildfire urban interface. And, you know, part of the reason you want to live in the forest is to live among trees. But defensive space means really just taking away all the vegetation around your house to a certain limit around your house, so your house is less likely to burn. Is that a workable solution, or is the answer to not live in some of these places?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's a good question, and folks, you know, really do have to evaluate, you know, where they want to be living in California. We think that the defensible space and mitigations that folks can do right around their home do make a big difference. So by all means, we understand how beautiful our forested landscapes are, but we also want to really lean in on education so folks are aware of, you know, what kind of risks are presented by overgrown vegetation around your home. And we have a number of programs, through CAL FIRE to help folks prioritize which mitigations to do. We have funded a lot of work through local fire safe councils that are extremely effective at reaching out to their communities and helping them plan the work. And we're really focused on how to really focus on education and provide resources and technical advice to help folks prioritize the work and get it done, because it's clear that it makes a huge difference.
Well, I think what we've learned also in the last 5 years is how great CAL FIRE is. You know, when you think, and these are the people who are fighting these wildfires, they're state employees, you know, as opposed to like the federal firefighting task, the forces, a little bit more stretched thin. Tell me, like, how your organization is supporting CAL FIRE, is making it more robust, because my understanding is it's hard to recruit people to do that job.
Well, CAL FIRE is an excellent organization, and I will tell you, the folks that are, you know, putting themselves in harm's way repeatedly just are amazing. And there's no question that, you know, these successive fire years have taken a toll. I will say we had a bit of a breather in 2022 and 2023, thanks to some just milder conditions and some of the work that had been done that was already starting to have an effect. But, you know, here we are back in to some pretty major fires this year. You know, again, with the legislature's help and from the governor's leadership, you know, we have really been able to add capacity at Cal Fire, you know, to the point that they are in, you know, close to 19,000 employees, I believe now, which is up significantly from when I first came into this role. And this is really helping to spread the workload. These are excellent crews that, when they're not responding to fires, can be out doing this kind of forest resilience work. So it's very gratifying to see the way that Cal Fire has been able to respond and really improve its capacity, but also lean on technology. There are incredible things happening through the use of cameras. There's a whole system called Alert California, that is able to detect fire ignitions much faster than anyone calling 911. So there have been many instances of fires that were, you know, firefighters were already responding because of these remote cameras were using AI to detect where smoke was that wasn't there the last time it spun around. And it's resulting in some really excellent response times. So I'm just, I'm very grateful to that organization for the way they are always thinking about how to improve their workforce. They have this huge responsibility for fire suppression, but then they also have this huge responsibility now that they are leaning into more and more on this forest health and forest resilience side of things. So it's an impressive organization.
Well, there's so much that your department is offering. So for a homeowner who wants to learn a little bit more about what they can do to harden their home, can you give us some advice of where they might go on the World Wide Web?
Sure. The Cal Fire site, fire.ca.gov. At the very top of the page, what we've got the fire map, and you can see all the incidents, but there's a new tab that says prevent, and it would take you to a lot of resources for things like home hardening. It will also show, you know, information on fuels treatments and, you know, the effectiveness there. They're starting to generate really excellent maps to show where this work is happening. So I think that's a good resource. And as I said, there are tremendous organizations locally through like fire safe councils or resource conservation districts that are also extremely sophisticated with excellent outreach and education to really help homeowners get ahead of this. So I think there's a lot of good stuff out there.
Well, you've given us a lot of good information and food for thought, and thank you so much for your work.
Thank you. Thanks for your interest. It's such an important topic. So I'm grateful for you bringing it up.
It really is. That was Lisa Lean-Mager. She's the California Deputy Secretary for Forest and Wildfire Resilience. And coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll continue our election coverage with a deep dive into both viewpoints on Prop D, which, if passed, would eliminate half of San Francisco's 130 city commissions. That's right after the break. Stay with us.
This is State of the Bay producer Katie Colley. Making well-informed decisions about our community and our nation this fall will require broad access to reliable information, clear thinking, thoughtful discussions, and the involvement of as many citizens and communities as possible. This is why KALW is so deeply committed to investigating deeply, reporting fearlessly, and illuminating our region and its people for all. So please do your part today to keep KALW fully empowered to deliver the important investigative reports and stories you'll count on through the election and beyond. Please join the KALW team today with a vital contribution, because we all deserve an exceptional, independent, public-centered source of news and culture here. It's easy to give online at kalw.org. Or call in your contribution to 1-800-525-9917. The number again is 1-800-525-9917. Consider a monthly gift to ensure KALW is always funded. Thanks so much.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Swan. We're continuing our election coverage to help you be more informed before you cast your vote on November 5th. Tonight, we're discussing San Francisco's Prop D, which would cut the number of city commissions from 130 down to 65. Proponents of the measure say that the 130 city commissions is a sign of city bloat and inefficiency. But opponents of Prop D argue that city commissions are a vital tool for both transparency and citizen input. We'd love to hear what you have to say, and we'd like you to be part of this conversation. How do you plan to vote on Prop D? Do you believe that the proposition will create a more streamlined, more efficient city governance? Or do you think that this proposition is designed to take away the voices of everyday citizens? You can give us a call, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So here tonight to talk about this proposition, we've got two wonderful guests. Joining us as a proponent of Proposition D is Rob Iavau, who is the Government Affairs Manager at Together SF. Together SF is a nonprofit organization with a mission to increase civic engagement and education in San Francisco. They also helped to get Prop D on the November ballot. Welcome to State of the Bay, Rob.
Thanks for having me, Grace.
Oh, pleasure. We also have Kristen Evans. She serves on the Homelessness Oversight Commission. She's a small business owner in San Francisco, and she opposes Prop D. Welcome to State of the Bay, Kristen.
Thank you so much for including me.
Yeah. Kristen, I wanted to start with you. As I said, you're a small business owner in the Haight. You own Booksmith and the Alembic, which is a favorite watering hole. Mm-hmm. And for listeners who are not familiar with this commission system, can you explain what a city commission does and how people are appointed to these commissions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's over 100 city commissions and committees, and Prop D essentially would eliminate half of them. It puts a new cap in at 65. So we basically have to, if Prop D passes, figure out which ones are worthy of keeping. They all have a little bit different role, and they were created over a long period of time. It includes things like the Police Commission, the Small Business Commission, the Health Commission, the Arts Commission, the Library Commission. I won't list them all, but basically there's a lot of them. And most of them are already mayor majority controlled in terms of the appointments. They range in terms of the number of commissioners and that are members that are on those bodies. Mine, the Homeless Oversight Commission, has 7 appointees, 4 by the mayor and 3 by the Board of Supervisors. You know, we serve two or four-year terms, and we're essentially appointed to provide, in my case, oversight of the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing. Also happens to be one of the newest commissions in San Francisco. Voters just created it when they passed Measure C in 2022 in November. The commission was created in May 2023, and we essentially oversee the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing. The budget of that department, which was created in 2015, has gone from about $250 million to about $700 million in a very short period of time. And so our body is charged with essentially looking at how that money is being spent, ensuring that the programs and policies are really working to achieve the goals that we want them to, specifically trying to get people housed off the street, and keep them housed.
Well, Rob Iavau, I wanted to turn to you. According to the documents filed to get Prop D on the ballot, Together SF wrote, quote, San Francisco has an absurd number of city commissions. There are approximately 130 commissions, over 1,200 commissioners, even though cities like Los Angeles and San Diego have fewer than 50 city commissions each. Many of our commissions are redundant, wasteful, and ineffective. Can you give me an example, Rob, of a commission that your organization believes is redundant, wasteful, and ineffective?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a pretty easy question to answer. I mean, the also in 2022, we had created the Streets and Sanitation Oversight Commission, which actually now oversees a department that does not exist. So this commission is providing oversight to no one as it currently stands. And that's just one example of the inefficiency that we're seeing within this commission system. And since most of the public doesn't know that about these city commissions and the commission and the power that some of these commissions can wield behind the scenes, it's actually become a hotbed for government corruption. I mean, we just saw a story come out last week around the Human Rights Commission and how the director there had given $1.5 million to her partner, who was also her roommate. And that's $1.5 million of public taxpayer money. And that's just one example, right, of the corruption that we're seeing here. And I mean, if we want to go back to ridiculous examples, we also have multiple commissions. I think it was seven of them that contributed to the now infamous $1.7 million toilet in Noe Valley. So the question really before voters is, are these commissions really providing a benefit to the public? And does the Arts Commission really need to weigh in the creation of a public toilet? Or is this something that we can actually, again, streamline, which is what Prop D wants to do, and focus on delivering outcomes for residents as opposed to getting caught up in the process and studying issues? So that's you know, just two examples of some of the redundancy that we're seeing here.
You referenced Cheryl Davis, who was on the Human Rights Commission and, as you noted, had directed funds to somebody who she has close ties to. And I'm curious, how would having fewer commissions have helped that situation?
Yeah. So this is the problem that we see here is that we have 130 commissions. And when we have 100, basically we're saying that we have 130 priorities here in the city, right? But when everything is a priority, when we have 130 priorities in the city, nothing is really a priority. And then it becomes a question of, you know, who is providing oversight for all of these commissions? The commission that Kristen is sitting on is actually one of five commissions. This was the fifth homelessness commission that we created. To provide oversight for a department that has, to her point, has a $700 billion budget. But do we need those five commissions to oversee one department, or can this be consolidated down? And so again, like, this commission system is something that not too many people in San Francisco, residents in general, are familiar with. They don't understand that there is this hidden layer of bureaucracy where they're making policy decisions for departments, where they're deciding who is going to be hired or fired for department heads. And it's making it really difficult for residents to understand who to hold accountable and really provide oversight for the people who are supposed to be providing oversight. I mean, the instance with Cheryl Davis is just one example of the Human Rights Commission. It wasn't too long ago that another human rights commissioner had accepted $20,000 from an undercover FBI agent. Mm-hmm. So when we have all of these people, 1,200 commissioners who are providing input into the city and the direction of our city, it's really hard for us to actually check in and see what are these people doing. And so that's what Prop D is doing. It's setting up a public process for us as a community, as a city, to come together and say, are these commissions still providing utility to residents? Do we actually need these? Are they providing services that are absolutely essential? Is this a priority for us?
Well, Christian, I mean, Rob is saying that there is an unseen layer of bureaucracy here in the city that most citizens don't know about. You oppose this proposition. Why?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, the big difference between Proposition D, which Rob is supporting, and then Proposition E, which I'm supporting, is the number of commissions that it would force the city to create. So I'm going to concede that, you know, there's been three analyses by the Rose Institute, the Civil Grand Jury, and SPUR, that basically said we do have too many commissions. And he gave some good examples, like the Homeless Oversight Commission is one of five commissions that oversee parts of the Department of Homeless and Supportive Housing. But, you know, they all were created for very specific purposes. Just as an example, he failed to mention that they would keep one of them, the Local Homeless Coordinating Board, which is required by federal law. So their measure basically does include keeping those commissions that are required by federal and state law. They named 22 charter commissions. So when you combine those together, it's about 45 commissions total. So that leaves about 20 slots to fit the remaining 80 bodies into only 20 slots. So he's essentially saying, like, the magical number is 65, but they don't have any defense of that number. Right. So when we crafted Prop E, I'm a volunteer, so I wasn't, you know, directly writing the language, but the folks that did, you know, conceived of also a way to really do a cost benefit analysis, do a rationalization, do a very good governance measure that we essentially will look at each of the commissions understand what are the value they're creating for San Francisco. Are they still necessary? Maybe they've outlived their purpose, and what they will make a recommendation to voters, and the voters will decide in 2026 on which commissions and committees should go based on those recommendations. I think Prop D was just a flawed measure. It was rushed to the ballot, and it was, you know, done behind closed doors. They basically wrote the measure in secret without, you know, public input. So unfortunately, it's very flawed. It does things like eliminate the Health Commission, which, you know, has to exist in order to be part of the governance of SF General and our public health system. They don't have an explanation for how they're going to address that if the Health Commission is eliminated or becomes advisory. The other
Let's. I mean, you make some really good points there, Kristen. And I wanted to go to the phones because we have a listener with a question about that. Merrick from the Castro, welcome to State of the Bay.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
And tell us, what's your position on Prop D?
So I am against Prop D. I am for Prop E. I do believe that we need to, you know, look at our city and county government and find ways to make it more effective. But I really believe that Prop D is dangerous, and I believe that in some ways it's pretty insulting.
What's insulting about it, Merrick?
You know, for me, for me, it's insulting, particularly about the Youth Commission. I am a former transitional age youth, LGBTQ youth, homeless youth, and also I'm someone who's written policy. And so for me, what's insulting is, you know, the Youth Commission is being targeted as part of this, and the opportunity for young people, especially Black, Brown, Indigenous, AAPI youth, to be involved in policy, get personal professional experience, and be able to make sure that their lived experience is reflected in the policy and have opportunities that otherwise they wouldn't. The Youth Commission is being targeted. And so it's insulting to me that Together SF actively shows that they do not value youth input and participation and opportunity. And I specifically would like to ask, you know, how does taking away those opportunities and cutting the Youth Commission actually solve the greater crises that the city is facing, which I think there's a lot that the city can face. But I don't think that essentially attacking the children and taking away some great opportunities from them is, in fact, addressing those issues and taking away red tape. So I'd like some specifics on how that is actually addressing those issues.
Well, Merrick,
taking away the Youth Commission.
Well, thank you for that question, Merrick. And let's take that directly to Rob Iavau, who's the Government Affairs Manager at Together SF. Is Prop D going to eliminate the Youth Commission? And is that the right commission to target?
So I'll start off by saying that Prop D does not eliminate any commission. That's misinformation. Prop D does not eliminate any commission. But I kind of want to go back really quickly to what Kristen had said earlier around the 65 cap and where that number came from, because I think that's helpful context for everyone. So again, we had actually commissioned a report out of the Rose Institute out of Claremont McKenna College, which is a leading good governance institute down in Southern California. And we hired them on to help us research and draft this legislation. So people who've been working in city government or have been studying this for decades, and they helped us draft this legislation. So, and they helped us come up with this number, a range of numbers for, you know, how many commissions San Francisco should have for a city of its size with the population that it has. And so, you know, looking at doing comparative analysis to other cities, city counties, we found that the range was between 40 and 65 commissions. And we ended up going with the 65 number because we do value public participation, and we think that this is San Francisco is unique. And so we wanted to make sure that there was room for, while we're going through this process, to make sure that there's room for things that, you know, are important to people or that this city really values. Going to, you know, whether or not this is decreasing the ability for people to participate in city government, I would completely argue against that. You know, as we're talking about youth and children here, I'm the father of a 2-year-old, right? I have a full-time job. I have to manage, you know, my 2-year-old when I come home. To think that I'm able to get down to City Hall on a Tuesday at 1 p.m. or make a meeting at 4:30 p.m. on a Wednesday while I'm also trying to do my job and also trying to manage my family life, you know, I think that's a fallacy. the idea that everyone is able to participate in these commission meetings is false. At the end of the day, what people really want to be able to do is to email their elected representative, the people that we elect to represent us in city government, whether it's the Board of Supervisors or the mayor, the people who are supposed to be leading and governing our city. And we want to be able to reach out to them, tell them our issue, and have them fix it, as opposed to having to figure out which of the five commissions related to homelessness or which of the five commissions related to children, youth, and families is the right one for me. And again, you know, there's five related to children, youth, and families. That's not including the numerous advisory bodies that they've spun up themselves. So there, we have advisors advising the advisory bodies. It's insane to me. It's ridiculous.
Well, Kristen, you mentioned that there's Prop E. So Prop E is going to create, if it's passed, a task force that would review each of the city commissions and then make a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors which ones to eliminate, if any. Do I have that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. And so we have a bunch of calls about this, and I'd love to get to some of them. Let's go to line three. Kent, welcome to State of the Bay.
Hi. Yeah, I have a question specifically about Prop E. My question is, why is the unelected task force in Prop E given the power to make their own laws? It seems undemocratic to give unelected city employees the power to make laws instead of keeping that with the elected Board of Supervisors. Isn't this just another example of a commission taking away power from our elected officials?
That's a good question. Kristen, let's take that to you. I mean,
I'm laughing to myself because Kent just read verbatim what off of the Together SF fact sheet.
Oh,
you know, it's literally not true. So both Prop D and E do create five person task forces, you know, call it a committee, call it a commission. It's a time bound task force to make recommendations around our commissions to the Board of Supervisors and ultimately to put recommendations for changes to the voters. The differences are, I think there's lets the mayor, city administrator, city attorney, board president and controller appoint the representative. And then Prop E, it's also the mayor, city administrator, and city attorney, but instead there's a union representative and a good governance expert. So it's slightly different in terms of the composition of who are the five, but basically in both Prop D and E, there's essentially a group of people that will be empowered to do the public hearings and analysis to see how which commissions and committees should be retained. I just want to emphasize again, the biggest difference between D and E is that D is extremely divisive because it caps the number of commissions at 65. So you're literally going to have like a Game of Thrones style, you know, knockout, drag out of commission advocates advocating for their commission. So you're going to have the Arts Commission facing off against the Library Commission, against the Small Business Commission. It's just very divisive the way that they have structured Prop D. And as I said, it was no secret because the Rose Institute, which Rob referred to, are basically like two guys, two professors in Southern California and some students. And they basically came up with a magical number. They said that there's some benchmark between counties and cities, but the reality is that San Francisco is both a county and a city, so their number's flawed. And I don't know if the magical number is 65 or 80 or 100, but you know, we should really make sure that we not just force a situation where we're cutting too many commissions without the analysis being done in public first.
Yeah.
I just want to say even in the analysis, again, we did look at city and counties. And if you look at San Francisco, given the size, all of this, of the other city counties have less than 100 commissions. We're still sitting at 130. Mm-hmm. And so this idea that, you know, we didn't do the research is, you know, absurd, especially since I've been working on this.
Well, I'd love to see it, Rob. You know, I haven't seen any analysis that says why you kept the 22 you kept, why you eliminated 24 charter commissions, and why they're no longer necessary. I didn't see that analysis. I don't think anyone has.
Well, let's leave that aside and let's go back to the phones. Line two, Julie from San Francisco. Welcome to State of the Bay.
Hi, my name is Julie Tron, and I work at the Bar Association, and I'm calling on behalf of the Bar Association of San Francisco. We almost never weigh in on these kinds of propositions. We're a 6,000-7,000 member organization, legal organization. We did a lot of research before we weighed in on this one, and we have weighed in firmly against Proposition D. I can speak to some of the commissions that we intersect with regularly, particularly the Police Commission, the Juvenile Probation Commission, and the Commission on the Status of Women. We work regularly with these commissions, and we depend on having this forum for a voice of the community. I can tell you that, in particular, working with the Police Commission, San Francisco needs to remember that it wasn't that long ago that the Department of Justice came in with 272 recommendations to our police department. We were way behind on our policy reform, and the Police Commission is set up to determine policy. We worked very closely with the police department itself and with the commission to make sure that our police department had the state-of-the-art policies on excessive force and biased policing, and we've done a great job with that. Our members have spent thousands of hours rolling up their sleeves and doing this hard work and working with these various commissions, and I must say I was very surprised to see that Proposition D doesn't just attempt to eliminate some of these commissions, it curtails the power of some of these commissions. And when you have the Department of Justice from the United States and the state of California, as well as the Court of Appeal, recognizing the critical role of our police commission in modernizing and reforming our department, I'm very troubled by this. With respect to the Juvenile Probation Commission, we also appear regularly before the Juvenile Probation Commission. There's no other way to bring matters to out to the public regarding conditions except through these commissions. So I think it's a vital and a crucial voice for San Franciscans to come. You can listen to it on the radio. You can listen to it online. You can call in. Most of these, certainly during COVID, there was a lot of that was going on. You can write to the commissions. There is, for those of us who have children and have a hard time getting to these evening meetings, there are a million ways to participate. And I've seen the health of these commissions and the wealth of their importance, and we really urge people to vote no.
Yeah. Well, Julie, it sounds like the Bar Association opposes Prop D. What is the Bar Association's position on Prop E?
We as an organization have not taken a position on Prop E. We didn't feel it was necessary. We agree that there's probably some commissions, as I think Rob pointed out, if it's true that there's a sanitation commission that doesn't oversee anything, then of course that needs to go. But, you know, the commission, that, I don't see that on the list of 24 to be eliminated. But I do see a lot of very vibrant commissions that are doing tremendous work. The Sheriff's Department Oversight, I know, is also another important commission.
Right.
And that seems to be on the chopping block.
Well, Julie, thank you so much for your commentary. We're running short of time, and I wanted to give Rob a chance to respond. I mean, the Bar Association of San Francisco opposes Proposition D, is what we're hearing. Rob, what's your response?
Yeah, I mean, you know, a few commissions were brought up just now. The Juvenile Probation Commission, I'm sure they do great work, but kind of, you know, going back to the Human Rights Commission scandal that we have with Cheryl Davis, James Spingola, who was her partner who received that $1.5 million, is still sitting on that commission. We do not have any way to remove him. I mean, why is he still sitting on that commission if he's caught up in this corruption scandal, right? And then going back to the Police Commission, you know, the Police Commission, what we've done in this measure is make sure that we retain civilian oversight of the Department of Police Accountability, and that the commission is also able to still manage the disciplinary cases against officers. But what we're not going to have is a police commission. But if Prop D passes, what we're not going to have is police commissioners who are advocating for kids to have guns or blaming our SFPD officers for rising overdose deaths, making policies on how those officers should be conducting their jobs. Instead, that's going to lie with the police chief, who I would think knows how to run the department better than people who have no experience in law enforcement.
It's a hot issue. I mean, right? This is a hot issue.
That was a stunning thing to say right there. I mean, can I just briefly say that we didn't get a chance to talk about the fact that the commissions that are retained are substantially weakened in the sense that the mayor, who currently has the majority of appointments, now gets a supermajority, and she can remove somebody at any time. If it's a she, right, or he, the mayor can remove, if Prop D passes, a commissioner for no reason at all, for no official misconduct. Now, Mr. Spagnola, if he's found to be in violation of corruption and official misconduct, he can be removed under the current system. So just to be clear.
That's never been done in the history of commissions here in San Francisco.
Well, that doesn't mean that it can't happen. And, you know, I know that there's a lot of corruption happening right now, scandals in San Francisco. But let me just say this, that the way to address corruption is actually not less transparency, it's more.
Yeah. I mean, it's a controversial topic. And we have a question from a listener. I want to give him a chance to come in. Line 2, Carlson, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you. Thank you, and thank you for taking my call. I actually have two questions. One is, what is the magic of about 65? Why set an arbitrary cap at 65 when we may determine after going through this exercise that we need 66 or 67? Or sometime down the road we need more than 65? Why tie the city's hands like that? And second, I read the Rose Report, and the authors note that they spoke to 30 people in preparation for their document. But they won't tell us who those 30 people are. They won't tell us if they're San Franciscans. They won't tell us whether or not they have a vested interest in getting rid of some of these commissions. So why the secrecy? Thank you.
Carlson, those are two good questions. We have a minute left. Rob, I'm going to give you a chance to answer that. And then, Kristen, I'll give you a chance to close it out.
Thanks.
Yeah, again, the 65 number came after thorough research, doing comparative analysis to other major cities. Again, Los Angeles and San Diego both have less than 50 commissions. And so giving us 65 would still put us over that. And mind you, both of those cities have much larger populations than San Francisco. And I forget what the second part of that question.
Didn't know who the 30 people who are.
Oh, the 30 people. Yeah, I mean that list. We did interviews with current and former elected officials. We did, and I've been doing outreach on this as a government affairs manager. I've been doing outreach on this measure for over a year now to labor, to organize labor, to neighborhood community groups. And so this idea that this was done in secret or that we're hiding something is completely false, concerning the fact that many San Franciscans did have a say in helping develop this legislation.
Great. And Kristen, last word on this. What would you like voters to know about D and or E?
Yeah, I just also would encourage people to follow the money. Prop D is being backed by this organization, Together SF, that is essentially representing the interests of a billionaire named Michael Moritz. He's throwing a lot of
money. Are we here to talk about policy or are we
Rob, we're just giving her the last. You had your chance. Let's give Kristen a chance to finish. We have 10 seconds left.
Yeah, I just want people to follow the money. There's over $2 million have been put in to support this Prop D and oppose Prop E. I think by comparison, we're just relying on people power to get the word out that we don't want a billionaire takeover of San Francisco. And we definitely want to keep our everyday person opportunity to give public input through our commission's process. So I definitely encourage people to vote no on D, yes on E.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. And listeners, thank you so much for your calls and comments. We couldn't get to everybody, but please definitely go to the websites of both propositions to make an informed decision. Thanks for joining us. That was Kristen Evans, a current city commissioner and small business owner here in San Francisco, and Rob Avayo, a government affairs manager for Together SF. Coming up after the break, we'll sit down with local author Caroline Paul, whose book Tough Broad profiles a group of women whose outdoor adventures not only enrich their lives, but help them live longer and healthier. Stay tuned.
This is State of the Day Bay producer Katie Colley. As you've just heard tonight, you can find enriching and lively and informed discussions of important election coverage and things going on here in San Francisco. KALW is deeply invested in the coverage that you'll need throughout the election and beyond. It's built on dialogue, connections, and a mutual understanding to keep all people of our region well-informed. I hope the segment tonight showed you how vital KALW is to our city, as well as keeping you informed. We urgently need contributions to help ensure KALW's resources are at full strength to serve you fully in all the ways that you count on. Please take this moment to contribute. It's easiest to give online at kalw.org or call in your contribution to 1-800-525-9917. Also consider a monthly gift to ensure KALW is always funded. Thank you.
I want to go to the mountains alone by plane to get home. Throw out my phone, tell everyone I'm gone. I'll be back in a moment. Remember that, keep track.
What if you could live longer and have a lot more sun to boot? That's the premise of Caroline Paul's new book, Tough Broad. From boogie boarding to wing walking, how outdoor adventure improves our lives as we age. The book profiles a group of women who are defying the stereotypes of aging. As we meet them, we learn how their willingness to take risks is enriching and possibly extending their lives. Caroline herself is no stranger to adventure. She's a former firefighter, rides a one-wheeler, has flown and jumped out of planes, and has written several books, including the New York Times bestseller, Gutsy Girl. I'm so pleased she's able to join us tonight. Caroline Paul, welcome to State of the Bay.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here, Anne. Thank you.
Well, we're so happy to have you here with us to talk about this really fun and informative book. You've led an exciting life yourself, but you chose to write this book about other women who are exploring adventures as they age. What inspired you to do that?
Well, actually, this isn't a book about other women. It's a book about fulfilling aging. And then I go and interview other women who are older than me to find out their insights into that. Because I myself was 55 and I was surfing and looking around and I didn't see any women my age on the waves. There were a lot of men my age and a lot of men older, but no women my age. And it was the same on my one wheel. It was the same when I flew my experimental plane. There just weren't women doing it. And so I began to wonder about my own aging journey. And that's how this book really came into being.
You had a role model for embracing new things as you age in your mother. Can you tell us about what her approach to aging taught you?
Well, it's funny. She didn't have an approach to aging. I don't think the vocabulary is there for generations before us, but she just wanted to open up her life. When she was 62, she had a series of knocks on her life. So she moved to a new town and she did things to try to be less lonely and more engaged in life. And she took up bicycling. And that did make her aging journey amazing, but she didn't do it consciously. But I saw that and was really inspired. And I don't think I realized it when I was younger, but she taught me that you can really blossom as you age.
Mm-hmm. I liked the line where you were walking along and she said, I wish I was 60 again.
Right. She was 80 at the time, or 85 maybe. And that line struck me because we think that someone's going to say, I wish I was 30 again. I wish I was 22 again. But in fact, all the women that I interviewed said to me that the 60s were their favorite decade. And I speak to you now at 61. And it's true. So
great. You also read about a woman who's 93, Dot, who shared a haiku with you that she wrote that said, when I go outside, every tree and blade of grass tells me I'm alive. Yes. What did you learn about integrating the outdoors in aging?
Well, I'd always been an outdoor person, but when I saw that women were not engaging with the outdoors, they were dropping off as they aged, I started to wonder if it was something I could keep in my own life. So I was doing research on fulfilling aging, and one of the things I found was that the way we look at our own aging predicts how well we age. So if we have a negative outlook on our aging, then we'll actually have a chance of heart attack earlier, we'll have a cognitive decline earlier. And the opposite is true. If you have a really positive, uplifting view about your future, you are happier, healthier, and you live 7.5 years longer. So this was incredible, but the scientists who did these studies, and there are many of them, did not give us a clue on how to actually get that positive outlook on our own aging. And for women, the messages that we get about our future once we hit really 40, but certainly 50, are pretty toxic, that we don't have a lot to look forward to, that we're not going to be contributing a lot, and that a lot of our currency is fading. And so my question was, how do you get that positive outlook? It began to be very clear to me that going outside is the single best antidote to all this negative messaging. Because, and I saw this over and over with the women that I interviewed, when you go outside, you upend all those messages that say that you're weak, that you're on a cognitive decline, and that you're boring. Because trust me, from boogie boarding in the Pacific Ocean to scuba diving with an 80-year-old, these women were not boring.
So it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy then, or feedback loop that you can feed in a positive way. Yeah.
Exactly.
You feature so many amazing women in this book, and some of them are from right here in the Bay Area. I would love for you to tell our listeners about some of the local women in Tough Broad. Maybe we could start with Shawn.
Yeah, Shawn is a base jumper. When I met her, she was 52 years old, and nothing about her seemed to be base jumpery. She was an ex-kindergarten teacher. She's a grandmother. She's African-American. And none of those fits our idea of what this rad base jumper outdoors person is.
Can you describe briefly what base jumping is?
Yeah, it's when you walk to the edge of a cliff and you basically hurl yourself off it and you free fall. And then at a certain point, you'd throw a parachute and glide to the ground. It's considered one of the most dangerous sports in the world. And Shawn was especially interesting because she's also a personal trainer in Marin. And a lot of her clients are women who are over 40 or 50 and have come to her because they feel all the things that the messaging is telling them, that they're on a physical decline and they're less strong and they're trying to combat that. And Shawn has realized that when you take people outside, it invigorates them in ways that is kind of magical.
Mm-hmm. I have to say the description of wing walking was pretty terrifying in your book. And then I further terrified myself by looking it up on YouTube. And my palms were sweating watching folks because they don't just walk out on the wing. They strap themselves in and then do loop-de-loops and all these crazy things. And you did that as well. What was that experience like for you? And what would you tell listeners who might not be comfortable taking those kinds of risks?
Well, I took that risk because 71-year-old Cynthia Hicks took that risk. And she told me, Caroline, you wouldn't believe the courage you feel when you first get up on that wing. And I thought, oh, well, I have to write about that because we all need courage. Yeah. The interesting thing was what I found was more than courage, because when the pilot started doing barrel rolls and loops and hammerheads up in the sky, and I was attached to the top of the wing, I understand adrenaline really well, from being a San Francisco firefighter to whitewater rafting around the world, or I've bike packed in countries and up mountains. So I knew when this pilot was doing all this that what I was feeling was not adrenaline. And I came back on the ground and I thought, what was that that I felt? And what I realized was what I had felt up there was awe. I was awestruck. And I did a deep dive into awe, and there's a lot of science about it now, but it turns out it's really good for us. And nature is a surefire awe trigger. So when you feel awe, you not only lower your blood pressure and strengthen your immune system, but you feel more gratitude and compassion. That's pretty great. You also feel more connected to the world. And these are all things that as we age, I think we start to lose. And so I found that awe is something that we can get when we go outside. And it just added to my repertoire of reasons why going outside radically and profoundly changes our bodies and our minds as we age.
Are there other, perhaps less death-defying ways of experiencing awe outside?
Yes. Well, here's the cool thing about awe. They did a study at UCSF where they asked people between the ages of 60 and 80 to go on what they called all walks, where you simply walk outside for 15 minutes, but they asked each volunteer to look at everything with fresh, childlike eyes. And what that did was it cultivated awe. It sort of accessed their awe. And people who went on all walks reported feelings of gratitude and compassion, much higher well-being, less depression and anxiety, something that definitely affects us as we age, compared to the control group who just walk like we normally walk, looking at their phones, thinking of their to-do list. By the way, we live in a world of anti-awe devices, the computer, the phone, which narrows our vision and makes us feel in control and powerful, exactly the opposite of awe, because awe is a feeling of wonder, a little bit of dread in the face of something bigger than us, like religious experiences, but also the Grand Canyon, Niagara Falls, and a beautiful flower or a bird song. So awe is amazing and we can access it. Do not wing walk. You don't have to. Just take a walk.
Excellent. I like that. Well, we'll have to leave it there. It's been such a pleasure talking to you. Caroline Paul is the author of the book, Tough Broad, From Boogie Boarding to Wing Walking, How Outdoor Adventure Improves Our Lives as We Age. Thank you so much for joining us on State of the Bay, Caroline.
Thank you, Anne. It's super fun.
And that's State of the Bay this week. Tonight's show was produced by Katie Colley and Chris Nooney, engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator. Stay tuned for Project 2025 coming up next. I'm Grace Wan. Good night, and thanks for listening.